Thank you. Marshall, if you could open court, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Flory, and Judge Bond, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, February 19th, 2025. We have three cases set for our oral calendar by Zoom, the first one of which is A24-1015. Enisved versus Enisved et al. And if I mispronounce the last names, my apologies. This, as I mentioned, is being this argument is being held via Zoom, and it is being recorded as well. An audio recording of this oral argument will be available to all the parties within a day or two after today. However, no other recording of this proceeding is permitted. Appellant, when you begin, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. There is a square that has a timer up there, so please be aware of how much time you have so you stay within the time limits. When you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And if we do run into any technical difficulties, we'll make sure that we make adjustments so that each party has sufficient time to make their arguments. So with that, appellant for or counsel for appellant, please state your name for the record and your name, and you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Eric Hansen. I represent the appellant in this matter, Stephen Enisved, because this is a matter between family members and everybody shares a common last name. For clarity's sake, I'll be using first names. The issue that's before the court comes forward on a pair of cross motions for summary judgment, and there are basically two arguments that I think that the court needs to resolve here. The first of which is the district court's determination that the purchase option agreement that was in the party's purchase agreement, whether or not that was material. The district court concluded that that provision was not a material component of the contract. We believe that that was error. And as a consequence, we believe that the district court erred in dismissing via cross motions for summary judgment the claims that Steve had against his brother and sister-in-law. I think by way of background, it's relevant to talk basically how did we get here? And basically what this is a dispute over farmland.
Counsel, can I just jump in and just take you right to the question of the contractual language and the question of breach? The purchase agreement's language as to the option, as I read it, is not directed towards Dean and Deborah the way the provision is in the option agreement that's later signed. And so the contract doesn't say, for example, buyers shall extend Leals the option for 5 years, or buyers agree that the Leals shall have the option for 5 years. So isn't that a significant issue in terms of the language of the contract and whether there was a breach here?
Your Honor, I don't believe it is significant for the purpose of our analysis. The question is, it goes to the specific language of that option agreement, and the option agreement provides that the Leals shall have an option to purchase 5 years. That's what is in the purchase agreement, and that is binding. And I think where that is relevant to this court is a purchase option is an irrevocable and continuous offer to sell. And we cited to Minor v. Skoog for that proposition. And by obtaining a waiver from the Leals, you undercut that provision of the contract. I didn't see the precedent think of it this way, but when I read the cases, I thought of it as it rendered it surplusage. What's the point of having this option provision if you can undo it? And it was clearly part of the purchase agreement. It was part of the basically what the parties agreed to. And what you had here was one party subvert the intention of the contract by eliminating that option agreement. So whether or not it's pointed directly at the leals or at, Steve's brother and sister, I don't think is a material difference in the contract language.
Counsel, and just to, just to, one quick follow-up, I guess, because your answer there, I think, used the language shall have the option. And the provision in the purchase agreement doesn't use the word shall have the option, right?
I believe that's correct. I'm double checking. We attached it in the addendum, Your Honor, but that's my recollection.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hansen, now the purchase agreement called for, I think, Dean and Deborah to sign the option and the Leals to sign the option and deliver it prior to closing. Does your argument change, or would your argument change if this waiver, because nobody disputes that they delivered the option, would your argument change if the waiver had been signed after the closing?
I don't believe it would, Your Honor.
Why not? How can you bind the Leals to a waiver they don't want?
Because they, all they had, it's to be
I mean,
clear,
to a purchase, a right to purchase they don't want. After the closing, it seems like by that at that point, everybody's fulfilled what the purchase requirement or purchase agreement required. And if someone decided to waive it after the closing, how would that be a breach of the contract?
I think there's a couple of different points, and at the closing, it might be that the purchase agreement, that the promises made in the purchase agreement are then integrated. But I don't, that's not our fact scenario here. And I think what's important is that they're not bound. There's nothing here in the sense that the Leals have to do anything. The question is whether or not this option to purchase sits out there for 5 years or not. I think that's the key question. I don't think there's anything affirmative that requires the Leals to do anything. The contract says that there will be a five-year option for these people if they choose to exercise it within that 5 years. And if they choose not to exercise it, none of the other parties to this contract have the ability to change that. That's within the Leals' prerogative. But I don't think that changes our legal analysis. And to be clear here, I think it is obviously particularly important that that on the facts that we have, this waiver of the purchase option occurs between the execution of the purchase agreement and before closing.
All right. I'm just wondering why it matters whether when the Leals would waive their option to purchase.
Because I as I read our case law on this, and I'll see if I can give you a quick cite. It talks that the language talks about a purchase option is that you can't alter it, that it sits out there for, until it expires. And to me that what they've done here is the direct opposite of that. They have altered it with the idea that they're going to undo this purchase option. And that I think is pretty clear that our law says you can't do that. A purchase option is an irrevocable and continuous offer to sell. That's Menard v. Skoog, 50 Northwest 2nd, 300, 302, 1951. I do not think you can reconcile that holding with the waiver that they're seeking to say happened here. It can't be irrevocable and continuous offer to sell, only for them to eliminate it prior to closing. And that was part of what the bargained for arrangement was. When we think of a contract for purchase of land, it's a number of different components. It's obviously the land, it's the price at a certain point, it's you a number of different factors, and a key component to this purchase agreement was this provision of a 5-year option to purchase by the Leals. And essentially what they did was the respondents here unilaterally rewrote the contract without telling Steve. And that's a breach of contract. That's not something that the court can grant summary judgment on and dismiss. They changed the terms of the deal. And our record is really clear here that had this been, had Mr. had Steve known about this, it would have been a higher price. And if you look to the record again, it makes it clear that the whole point of this, why this purchase option was here, was it was part of the way it was handled from the inheritance. That there was a requirement on Steve to give the option for his siblings to match an offer. They didn't match an offer, they changed the offer.
Also, on the fraud claim, as I understand it, that claim goes to the point in time of closing, that there was a failure to disclose that this option agreement had been waived at the time of closing. And I just wanted to clarify, you're not claiming your fraud claim doesn't go to either the signing of the purchase agreement or the signing of the option agreement. Is that clear? The point, is that right? The point in time we're looking at is closing.
It certainly is to closing. I think our record is a little unclear as to when this waiver happened. And so I don't want to foreclose that it was at the time of the option. I don't know if it was presented as two pieces of paper. Here's the option we're going to sign, and here's the waiver, and we're going to sign those contemporaneously. But certainly by the time we get to the closing, that is. At that point, there's an obligation to disclose because they have unilaterally changed the terms of the deal and done so in a way that conceals that information from Steve.
Mr. Hansen, you argue in the alternative that summary judgment is appropriate for Steve, but for both the breach of contract and for the fraud claim. But you also argue in the alternative that there's an issue of material fact. Is it, I mean, I understand that you're making arguments in the alternative, but this is on summary judgment. And summary judgment, we look at the facts in the light most favorable to Steve, as well as any inferences. But you alluded to the record still unclear on some matters. Isn't it really an issue here that while certain facts are undisputed, there's still some facts that need to be clarified that would preclude summary judgment for either party?
Your Honor, as I read the briefing here, I don't think that this needs to be remanded. Yes, we did plead that as an alternative, and there is a case that says whether non-performance rises to the level of a material breach, that's a question of fact. So that's the Cloverdale Foods case. I think that is an argument for what, as an alternative argument. But I really do genuinely believe that this should be a reversal by this court, and not just a remand on summary judgment, because and it really goes to material facts. I don't think there is an interpretation of the facts where you can say that the purchase option to the Leals was immaterial. I think that that's a question of law. I think that is something that this court can and should reverse on. And
But
so,
whether non-performance rises to the level of a material breach is generally a question of fact for the fact finder, though. It seems like there's several issues of that if they're that would need to go to a fact finder.
I believe on the question of whether or not the respondents breached the purchase agreement, I don't believe that that requires any additional material facts. I believe that the material facts in the record are undisputed to resolve that question. And so I respectfully disagree that, to the extent that there's further fact finding necessary, I believe that the parties have made it crystal clear that this was done without Steve's knowledge, and I think that it is well within this court's purview to take a look at it and say, "Yep, that's a material component," because otherwise, what is the point of having a purchase option if you can just get rid of it? I don't think that you can conclude as a matter of law that simply removing a 5-year purchase option is not material. And I think really that goes to the Kuhn case, KUHN v. Dunn. I think that that case is pretty on point as to materiality. And I think it goes to the language that the Supreme Court says is we conclude that a material breach is a breach that goes to the essence of the party's agreement, affecting the purpose of the contract in a vital way. I don't think you can come to a contrary conclusion on these facts.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
We will now turn to counsel for respondents, and it looks like we have the clock set at 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and party you are representing, and you may begin.
My name is John Saunders, and I represent Dean and Deb Ennisfett. May it please the court, counsel. This is the appellant has agreed in their reply brief that this is an unambiguous contract. And yet in its argument, appellant talks about the intention of the parties was clearly to have an option agreement. Under state law, if it's unambiguous, the language of the contract must provide materiality. And the court so found in its findings, it said if that was important, it should have been, and this is a quote from the trial court's decision, there is no requirement in the purchase agreement that the option agreement remain in full force and effect for a full 5 years, and no contingency clause indicating that the sale would not occur if the Leals did not accept or waive the option. I think the court was right
Also,
on.
didn't I mean prior to closing, your clients by executing the waiver of the option, they caused that provision in the purchase agreement to become void and irrelevant. Why isn't there at least a factual question as to whether that was a material breach?
Because the case law that is cited by counsel saying that an option agreement has this four-legged stance and it can never be modified is a case dealing with the seller trying to back out of an option agreement. This is at Leal's option, which means by the very language that was put in by the appellant's attorney when he drafted this, it made it Leal's option to terminate this at any time. It doesn't say.
Wait a minute, counsel. Where in either the option agreement or in the purchase agreement does it state that the Leals have the option to terminate it? I understood the plain language of the option is to that they may purchase the property. That seems to be the only power that they're given under the purchase agreement and the option contract.
Right, Your Honor, it says on the front first page of the purchase agreement, which is Addendum 11, Leal at his option may purchase the property from the buyer. It doesn't say he can terminate it, but it is saying that it's at his option. And then one thing that I think is
So
relevant.
how could the Leals execute a waiver if they have no right to terminate that option provision?
Well, it doesn't say they could never terminate it, though, either,
Well, but it
right?
doesn't, but you're only given the powers that are in the agreement itself. So the only power that the Leals are given is the right at their option to purchase the property. They're not given a right to waive, they're not given a right to modify it, they're not given a right to extend it, to shorten it. So you're just looking at the plain language of the purchase agreement option contract. I don't see how they could have waived that option.
Well, to me, it appears that the language which says at their option gives all the power to the Leals in the case that was cited by the appellant saying that a option agreement is irrevocable is dealing with the seller is always obligated to sell under an option agreement, but an option agreement by its very definition allows the buyer to either buy or to not buy the property. Now,
I understand that, counsel, but that language that you cited says, quote, Leal's, comma, at his or Leal, comma, at his option, comma, may purchase the property. It seems like the agreement is only given Leal one. There's only one thing they can do, and that is to purchase the property. It doesn't say anything about terminating the option contract at all. So I'm struggling with how they could have waived it at all.
I don't see a prohibition against waiver, first of all. But second of all, let's say that the waiver never occurred and Leals continued to have this option. It would be at the Leals' option to exercise it. The appellant has not suggested that the waiver be thrown out by the court because he understands the Leals would never exercise this option. He wants the original purchase agreement rescinded so that he gains control over this property. That's never the intention here. The intention was that Leals would have the option. And so he's trying to circumvent what was a failed plan, having the Leals, who he had full access to, could talk to at any time.
Mr. Sanders, I understand all that background, but that's irrelevant to our analysis here. Our analysis is whether, does the purchase agreement say? What do the options say? And I want to turn to something that I didn't see in your brief at all, and that's a discussion of materiality with respect to the option contract. It's my understanding that under the undisputed facts that Steve required the option agreement to be in there in the purchase agreement and have it signed, and in exchange, the price for the property would be lowered. And so if the option agreement and the lease are directly tied to the price of the property, why doesn't that go to the essence of the contract? Why isn't that material to the purchase agreement?
It's our position, Your Honor, that you have to go into the intentions of the party to even get to that discussion. And if it's an unambiguous contract, the terms of this contract are all that's relevant. And my client provided the option agreement at closing. He followed everything, and I think it's undisputed by the appellant that my client provided all of the requirements of the purchase agreement. And so, in order to determine that the reason there was an option agreement is the price would be lower, you have to go to extrinsic facts, which aren't allowed when there's an unambiguous contract. So, our position is that the trial court correctly determined that based on the agreement, and I would just point to paragraph 2 of the purchase agreement. It says, buyer agrees to lease the property to Juan Leal and Carrie Leal. That's an agreement that's enforceable, but he didn't use the same language on the next paragraph. It was all for Leal at his option, which is, if you're looking at the plain language, would indicate that Leal could do at his option anything with that land, including waive his rights to purchase it.
Well, I think you're reading into the contract, the purchase agreement language that I don't see there, but you raise an interesting issue of whether or not, well, let me ask you a question. Do you think that there are no disputed facts and that summary judgment is appropriate?
If you look at the contract itself, which the appellant has agreed is unambiguous, my client did not breach anything in that contract. In order to get a material breach, you have to bring in the intentions of the party and what they thought the agreement provided for in order for there to be a breach. And it's our position that on an unambiguous contract, you can't look at those issues. So I think summary judgment's appropriate based on the all fours of the purchase agreement. And as well, Your Honor, the last paragraph of the purchase agreement says that there are no, the purchase agreement shall constitute the entire agreement between the parties. This purchase agreement supersedes any or all written or oral agreements between seller and buyer and may be only modified in writing. And so we believe that the trial court was correct in looking at all fours of the agreement and realizing that these intentions that appellant talks about are irrelevant to the court's determination in this case.
So let me ask you a follow-up question then. Let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree with Steve that there was a breach of contract and that there was fraud. Would you then agree that summary judgment is appropriate for Steve on either one or both counts then?
No, I believe if the court makes that decision, then we're talking about intentions, and we have to provide evidence to the trial court about was the price lowered because of the option? What was discussed? What was known by each party? All of that becomes relevant. And I do want to touch base on the fraud issue because the case law is clear and Klein that there is no duty to disclose unless there are special circumstances. And both cases cited by the appellant would provide those special circumstances are irrelevant in this case. So first of all, Dean and Deborah never spoke to Steve. And so one of the special circumstances is one who speaks must say enough to prevent his words from misleading. And they never said anything. In the Swedeen case that was cited, the insurance agent actually said, yes, this policy is the same as the old one. The second provision is one who has special knowledge of material facts to which the other party does not have access. And he cites Williams versus Smith. In Williams versus Smith, the Supreme Court said that they were of equal footing. And we would argue the same in this case. Steve wanted an option for Leals, and they were his son-in-law and his daughter. They had just as much access to the Leals to determine whether they would exercise this option. And it's at Steve's peril that he provided an option totally in control of Leals without ever talking to them. But he had equal access. So we believe fraud is not appropriate in this case because there was no duty to disclose and there were no special circumstances. The third being fiduciary duty, and there was no fiduciary duty between these parties. So I just wanted to get that argument in, but I would answer or make myself available for any other questions.
Yes, Mr. Sanders, I want to go back. Go ahead, Judge Fleury.
Well, as I've listened to both arguments here, and you both can respond if you wish, I'm struggling with this concept that the Leals can be bound by the terms of a contract that they weren't a party to. Can you point me to any case law or other law that helps resolve that conflict? I don't know if this goes to the materiality issue or what, but it troubles me that the arguments here are centering around whether or not the Leals are bound by a terms of a contract that they clearly weren't a party to. What's your thoughts on that issue, Mr. Saunders?
Well, Well, first of all, I think that gets back to the case that was cited by the appellant saying that this option is like has a life of its own. I think those cases, if you look at them, we're dealing with the seller trying to avoid their obligations. And liens are not bound by anything, in my opinion. They have an option. They have a right that they can waive, exercise, or do whatever they want with. But I don't think they're bound by anything. And that would be my position. I think if they wanted to bind the liens, I don't know that they could do it in this agreement, but they could have bound my clients to offer a five-year option if they would have used different language, the same language they used to require my clients to lease the property to liens. They could have used that same language if it was material and important to them. They could have used that same language to force my clients into a five-year period of providing the liens, but they didn't. They provided the liens the option with no requirements for us to follow that. Other than if we go outside of the contract and we get into the mind of Steve Ennisfed. If we get into the mind of Steve Ennisfed, he would argue, well, of course, that was a material purpose of the lease or of the purchase agreement. But we have to leave the contours of the purchase agreement to get to that point.
Why do we have to leave the contours of the purchase agreement? Because the purchase agreement explicitly in paragraph three that you had mentioned requires the option contract to be a part of it. So it I'm not sure we need much explanation beyond that.
Well, it says that we have to execute a option agreement to provide liens the option to purchase a property, and we did that.
I have one last question, and that is, you'd mentioned earlier that the purchase agreement does not allow Steve the right to modify, control, or revoke the option unless it's explicitly in writing. What gives Dean and Deborah the right to draft and sign a contract modifying the option contract that's expressly included as part of the purchase agreement then? I mean, doesn't that work both ways?
Yeah, and that was argued at the trial court, but they didn't modify the agreement. They entered into an agreement with the Leals, which weren't even part of this. And so the question is, if they enter into a contract with the Leals, who aren't even a party to this contract, and it's Leals' option, it's the Leals' option, they're not changing this agreement. This agreement stands on all fours.
But wasn't the option? Well, I have two points on that. One, the option contract was incorporated into the purchase agreement, so it is part of the purchase agreement. And in your own words, in your brief, you said that the option contract was, quote, nullified by waiver. So isn't it modifying the purchase agreement then?
Well, it's not our position that it is, because on all fours, we did everything that the purchase agreement required us to do. And that was found by the trial court as well.
Thank you, counsel.
I don't see
any other questions. So we'll return back to appellant's attorney for 5 minutes of rebuttal. And you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start where Mr. Saunders and I agree. The Leals, and this is in response to Judge Flores' question, I don't view this contract as binding the Leals. What this contract did was it bound Dean and Deborah to sell to a particular person at a particular price for a period of 5 years. And that's what paragraph three does. To expand on your question, Your Honor, I think you could have put anybody's name there. This was a negotiated provision in the purchase agreement that Dean and Deborah agreed to and then unilaterally rewrote. I think Your Honor, Judge Reyes, I think you correctly focused on the relevant point here. The parties can't modify this. You can't unilaterally write this out of the contract. This is what was agreed to. And if our contracts are going to have any meaning and any enforceability, you can't undo a portion of that contract via a secret agreement. And that's what we've got here. And so ultimately, I think that that goes then to, this is a breach of contract. So then I think we have to go to the next question, which is it material? And I would say, I go back to my argument that to me, this sounds in this language about how we construe a contract as a whole. We don't render provisions of its surplusage. You can't have this provision mean anything if you can just write it out and it's not material. And so I think that that can be decided as a matter of law. During Mr. Saunders' argument, I was taking another look at the Kuhn case. Supreme Court decided, and the Supreme Court ultimately said, yes, normally we would remand this matter for findings of fact on the question of materiality. And in that case, the key question was whether or not a transfer provision included basically an intestate transfer upon death. And the court said, you based on the record, because we know what the intent of the parties was here, and this has been adequately briefed, we can decide this issue. And I think that this panel has the same ability here. It's clear based on the record that we have. And contrary to Mr. Saunders' points that, somehow this contract is ambiguous and that's the only way we get to any of the extrinsic evidence, I think that the materiality component on cross motions for summary judgment was adequately briefed on this point. So I think that there isn't a need to send it back to the district court.
Mr. Hansen, how do you respond to Mr. Saunders that the minor case is distinguishable because that involved an option directly between the buyer and the seller in the contract?
I don't see anything in the language of that decision that supports his reading that is a crucial component, Your Honor. I don't think that that point matters. I think that I would basically go back to my previous statement. I think that paragraph 3 of this purchase agreement could have said anybody on the planet at a specific price. And if the parties sign it, then they're bound by it. And whether or not that purchase agreement was to the Leals or somebody else isn't a relevant point. And I don't think I've seen any case law that suggests otherwise. Unless there's further questions, I'll just wrap up. I see we're close to the end of time anyway. This court should reverse the district court and a direct entry of judgment in favor of Steve, because it is clear that this contract was breached by Dean and Deborah by basically a unilateral rewriting of the contract, and that is a breach of contract. District court erred in granting summary judgment against Steve. This court should reverse it. That's the relief we're requesting. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your oral arguments and your briefing. We appreciate it. And I'm sure your clients do as well. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.